Podcast listeners, you've listened to the podcast. Now you want the chance to come on the program yourself. So here it is. Do you remember those books, Choose Your Own Adventure, where you would pick where to go next and follow that story? Well, help us flesh out the VitBuckle Society complication session at the annual meeting in March 2020 by submitting your surgical videos of your complications in vitreoretinal surgery. These videos can be narrated or anonymous with the description to mklufas@gmail.com. That's mklufas@gmail.com. We all learn more from reviewing our mistakes as groups and with our colleagues, so this is a great learning opportunity. And two big things, the top five entries will be shown during the meeting and discussed by a panel discussion, but more importantly, if you're one of the top five entries, we'll invite you to come on the podcast for a one-on-one interview to discuss the case and learning points. The winning entry out of the five will then win a special VitBuckle Society buckle, so send your entries to mklufas@gmail.com. That's mklufas@gmail.com. Thank you.
Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreather. Today on episode 204, we are back with the Journal Club. Drs. Priya Sharma and Shriji Patel join me to discuss four recent ophthalmology publications about the cost benefits of anti-VEGF injections for age-related macular degeneration, diabetic macular edema treatment trends, pentosan polysulfate maculopathy incident, and posterior vitreous detachments and retinal breaks and detachments. Links to all four articles can be found in the episode description. A list of financial disclosures will be attached in the episode description. And remember, you can claim CME credits via the AAO website for select episodes. Simply click on the link in the episode description to claim your credits. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now happy to be back with the Journal Club. I am joined by two retinal specialists. From the East Coast, first in alphabetical order, Dr. Shriji Patel from Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee. Shriji, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, absolutely, Jay.
And also Dr. Priya Sharma from the Retina Group Washington in the Washington, D.C., Virginia, Maryland area. Priya, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Jay.
And so what we're going to do, just like with all our journal clubs, we have four articles published in major ophthalmology journals from the last month and a half, and we're going to go through them. And kind of go through them in a very systematic fashion, talk about limitations. So the first one we're going to talk about was published in JAMA Ophthalmology by Mulligan et al., with Mark Humayun as the senior author. It's titled, An Economic Value of Anti-VEGF Factor Treatment for Patients with Wet Age-Related Macular Degeneration in the United States. Shriji, you want to tell us a little bit about this article and what they showed?
Yeah, absolutely. So essentially, this article was looking at the economic value of anti-VEGF therapy kind of on a broader scale in patients with age-related macular degeneration with exudative changes in the United States. And essentially, the idea here is, you know, the cost of these medications have clearly gained a lot of interest nationally. And so what they did was using data from clinical trials on expectations for visual outcomes, they essentially created a simulated cohort of 168,820 patients with newly diagnosed wet AMD who were 65 years or older, and then they tracked them over 5 years looking at the expected visual gains based on clinical trial data and then the economic and societal value gains associated with those visual gains compared to the average drug cost for the three anti-VEGF agents. And so essentially, and they did this comparing two of the current treatment protocols, essentially where we do a less frequent injection protocol, which might be more of a treat and extend, and a more frequent injection protocol. And then they also did it in a scenario where over time, if you assumed that we were able to get improved adherence or better outcomes, what types of economic benefits we would get with that. And so the long and the short of it is, kind of any way you cut it, based on regardless of how you inject or how frequently you inject, there's significant gain associated with the visual gains from repeated anti-VEGF therapy. And again, this is using a weighted average of the three medications. So about an $898 drug costs associated with these medications, along with the injection cost. They simulated OCTs and fluorescein and everything. And so they're able to say that, you know, the societal value ranges from about $1 to $3 billion across 3 years in any of the treatment scenarios, and over $4 billion in their enhanced treatment scenarios. And so this kind of is able to assign a finite number in terms of the value that's gained outside of when you're comparing just the visual qualities along against the drug costs.
So this is the type of study that, and you did an amazing job kind of breaking that down, that's either, and you explained it really simply, it's either really simple or really confusing, depending on how you look at it. And I think similarly, the results, this is the sort of binary thing where some people say this is really, really critical, and other people kind of look at this and scoff and say, you know, there's so many limitations to this analysis that what is it really useful for? But I do think, and you really highlight this, I do think there are some useful things here. I think the interesting thing is, regardless of the way you use anti-VEGF first, is there is economic value. And I think that, that we all kind of understand that implicitly and anecdotally, just from the fact that you're preventing a blinding disease and you're getting patients' vision and, you know, maintaining function, people keeping people functional where they don't need as much aid. There's financial benefits to that. And blindness carries a, unfortunately, a very, not only in addition to like the human psychological aspects, does carry a huge societal burden and a financial burden. So it's an interesting way to look at it. Limitations of this analysis, you know, there are many versus the assumptions based on these trials, which are not the same population. So kind of using two different sets of patients for these analysis. They modeled out the outcomes. And then, you know, they talk about how they don't have any kind of discussion of indirect costs. They're really just talking about in terms of visual acuity. So they're not talking about falls, depressions, caregiver burden, all these things that, you know, we would kind of factor in. So they're saying there may even be underestimating the kind of impact of anti-VEGF, which is interesting because it's still a very, very large impact. So Priya, when you hear kind of this conclusion about the impact, I mean, I don't think it's surprising. It's still interesting to kind of see it shown with a pen, like in a tabular form mathematically. What does it mean for you? I mean, does it change anything in terms of how you view treat and extend versus monthly therapy versus PRN therapy, for example?
You know, I don't think it necessarily changes my management, but it gives me confidence that regardless of which management protocol I'm choosing, that I'm, you know, I guess adding economic value in such a way. And I think one of the strengths of this is in the current, you know, current market, there's always, you know, this emphasis on cost of medication, which is obviously very important. But this shows that regardless, we are adding a tremendous economic value to society by doing these medications.
Yeah, Sriji, you know, any kind of thing else you want to add in terms of take-home points for this study?
Yeah, you know, I agree. There's a lot that could be, you know, nitpicked about this study, but, you know, if you really want to, you know, in its most simplest terms, really what we're trying to do is assign value to something that we all value quite a bit, which is vision. But it's really tough to assign numbers to that. When we talk about drug costs, that's very tangible. That's very easy. So, well, these drugs are very expensive. It's costing a lot on an annual basis. But, you know, I've always been vocal that, you know, these drugs, while they do cost a lot, and that is an issue that we need to kind of work on, the value gain versus, you know, 15 years ago when we didn't have anything for these patients and many of them would incur legal blindness at a fairly young age, I think that value gain offsets the drug price quite a bit. And this is nice because it really does assign numbers that you can point to justify some of these drug costs that we're seeing.
So kind of moving forward and along a similar vein, the next study is from Ophthalmology. It's a brief report called Treatment Patterns for Diabetic Macular Edema. This was an IRIS registry analysis. Priya, just want to tell us what they kind of looked at in this short report and what they showed?
Yeah, absolutely. So this was a retrospective review of IRIS registry data, specifically looking at the first treatment for DME patients within the first 28 days after initial diagnosis, and looked at these patients over 1 year of follow-up. And what they were looking at is they wanted to see what the initial treatment choice was, and they wanted to follow these patients over 1 year. And so they ended up looking at about 13,000 patients. The way that they found these patients were from a diagnosis code that indicated that they had diabetic macular edema. And I think figure one kind of summarizes the results of this report very well. It shows that the majority of patients, over 9,000 patients, received no treatment within the first 28 days of diagnosis. And actually, 8,000 of them continued to receive no treatment. They were just observed up to 1 year. Of the patients that were treated, 71% were treated with bevacizumab, 17.1% with aflibercept, and 11.6% were treated with ranibizumab. The median number of injections for these patients during the first year was around four. And like I said, the majority of patients actually received no treatment in the first year following diagnosis. Of the patients who were just observed, the baseline vision in those patients was characterized as moderate visual impairment, but that remained stable over the entire year of follow-up. However, patients who received anti-VEGF treatment within the first 28 days and who received six or more injections over 1 year achieved greater one-year visual gains compared to those patients who received prompt anti-VEGF treatment but received only 1 to 5 injections over the same period. And so I think what this study shows is that, this is the way that diabetic macular edema is currently being treated in practice, according to the IRIS Registry data. And it does suggest that maybe DME is undertreated, but it is interesting that so many patients are observed. Now, I will say that all of these patients are identified based off of coding data, and our code is our code for diabetic macular edema is simply just DME. We don't stratify that into non-visually significant DME or clinically significant diabetic macular edema. And so that's one of the big things that we have to interpret this data with some caution, as we don't know those patients who are being observed. We don't have OCT data to compare that to.
I think that you did a great job summarizing. There's something really interesting to hear. I think timing, as you mentioned, is super important. This is data that is from 2013 to 2016 in terms of when they kind of came in for their first exam. This predates Protocol V, which we've talked about in the podcast. So this is before the standardized trial data saying that observation for patients with good vision and DME was appropriate and many, many cases. This is before that, and it still shows that people are still treating less. And I think this is important because I think this has been shown before where there may be some perception that retina specialists are always treating their patients, but actually we kind of talked about in the last study, Sriji, sometimes we quote-unquote undertreat relative to trials, and I think that shows that, again, there's a burden to injections, and maybe we just make wishful thinking. Sometimes we think that we don't need to treat. In the case of DME, I think that there's some, even before Protocol B, there was some understanding that you didn't have to treat every single patient with DME with anti-VEGF, that you could observe appropriately good follow-up and get good outcomes. They did talk about limitations in terms of, IRIS data is messy because it relies on the Snell and visual acuity collected at a retina practice. It may not be best corrected visual acuity in many cases. So that's a huge limitation in terms of looking at this. But it's still useful because, again, like any database, it's large number of patients. And it's interesting to kind of see what's happening in the real world. Sriji, your reactions to this paper, any other thoughts you have on top of that?
I was thinking to myself, I wonder what type of practice setting these patients are being seen in. It would be nice to get some idea if these patients are being observed in a retina setting or, in a general ophthalmology setting. I think that would give us more information also just in this idea that, for at least my practice, I have a lot of patients that travel very far to see me, and it's nice just getting an idea about what the practice patterns are across the country in terms of are these patients being followed, with, the majority being observed, maybe at a practice outside of, a specialty practice. We can see here that, this was 2013, it's 2016, but, assuming these trends are, stable, quite a few of these patients are doing fine. They're not losing any vision being observed. And again, like you mentioned, the DRCR data really does, put a bow on that subject. But it's nice to see that it's actually already being applied in clinical practice.
Okay. Any other thoughts on this paper and implications it has for practice?
I think that it again, is nice to just show that observation is okay and those patients who had moderate visual impairment remain stable over 1 year. I think it also shows that, I think with all of these papers, for me, it just shows what I tell to the patient. And when I see a patient, I can now say with a little bit more confidence that this is what retina providers over the country are doing, and we're doing a kind of what the standard of care is, and following clinical-based and evidence-based medicine. And so I think that's the biggest thing that it adds for me.
Were either of you surprised by the number of patients who were treated within 28 days with laser? You know, it was not a huge, percentage-wise, it's not huge. It's 1,133 out of, you know, 100-something thousand. So you're talking about less than 1%. But I'd be interested to see if that's decreased over the study period that remains stable. I feel like laser, people still do it, but I think it's probably less common now, Shriji, right, than in the past.
I'd have to imagine so. You know, I wonder, you know, and this is where the data obviously kind of the trail ends here. But you wonder if laser was offered, you know, sometimes laser can be curative and be much more reasonable to working age population than monthly injections. And so sometimes you wonder if that was initially offered to see if it could stave off non-center involving DME or treat people that really could not afford to come, you know, monthly for these treatments.
Yeah, that's a great point. Well, moving forward, the next study from ophthalmology is pentosan polysulfate sodium exposure and drug-induced maculopathy in commercially insured patients in the United States by Ludwig et al. Darius Mashfeghi was the senior author. The study was from Stanford. And I'll just summarize, you know, again, the brand name for this drug is Elmeron. There have been reports of Elmeron maculopathy, and Elmeron's a medication used for interstitial cystitis, and there's been reports from Emory originally of these patients who present with maculopathy related to pentosan polysulfate. So what they did here is they had a huge database of commercially insured patients, over 200,000 patients with interstitial cystitis, and of those patients, they went and kind of looked at basically, is there any association between exposure to this medication and maculopathy? So again, this is a retrospective study. They found that the most common diagnosis of maculopathy in these patients was not common, but about 1.5% of these patients had wet AMD, 0.3% of dry AMD, just under 1% drusen. Toxic maculopathy was basically 1 in 1,000 of these patients. And they saw that basically patients who had filled a prescription for this medication and were later diagnosed was similar to patients who did not fill a prescription. The big take homes here is they essentially said there was no association between exposure to the drug and diagnosis of maculopathy. So this is interesting. I would say, again, it's a large database of patients, and it's just kind of looking to see, is this a really common problem or is this something that's not? And they didn't see any exposure. And again, there's problems with the type of analysis, just like there's problems to simply reporting cases where there's been exposure. Neither of them is, they're kind of complementary pieces of data. Priya, when you hear this, read this study, we've heard the reports of this issue. How does this factor into what you believe about this toxicity? How do you interpret this and kind of take this in as we get patients who are starting to ask questions about this medication?
You know, that's a great question, Jay. I have definitely had an increased awareness of this ever since all of these reports have been coming out, especially with those patients that you see with atypical macular degeneration. And I found this very interesting that they didn't find a significant difference between patients who had pentosan polysulfate exposure and those who didn't. That being said, they did mention in the study that the average follow-up for these patients was around 5 years. And I wonder if that's just not long enough of a time to establish toxicity. You know, there are other reports, and on average, those patients are on this medication for around 15, 20 years. And so that's one of the things that I want to pause and say, you know, perhaps that's one of the biggest limitations of this is there's just not enough follow-up. They didn't find a dose-dependent relationship in this study between exposure and maculopathy, but again, it just may not have been enough time. I still think regardless, this is helpful to know that at least in that first 5 years, perhaps there is not a huge difference. But I still think for me, any patient who's on this medication should be counseled that they have a risk of maculopathy until we have definitive evidence that proves that it doesn't happen at a much longer duration of time.
Yeah. I think that those are all really great points. I mean, Shriji, Priya did a kind of a great summary of her feelings on this subject. In terms of big limitations, obviously, the study are present. We still need more data. They talk about the need for more data. This is still something we can't ignore. We kind of have to keep looking. At least it's comforting, I guess, that there's not a strong association, that so that even if this is a risk, hopefully it's a rare risk.
Yeah, I thought, you know, the most salient point was brought up by Priya. You know, I completely agree with something like hydroxychloroquine or chloroquine. These toxicities can take years and years to develop. It is nice that it's not this toxicity that starts almost immediately, because we can see within 5 years, there really doesn't appear to be an association. The authors point out, in terms of future avenues, coding data obviously has its own, you know, flaws. And really, if we want to look at these patients, we probably need some type of imaging to get signs of toxicity, especially because it could be preclinical, it could be subtle, it might not be something that is easily picked up and coded for. And so if we really want to pin this down, I think this is helpful, but I don't think that it proves in one way or the other, the argument at this point.
Great points. You know, we're going to slide on to this last study here, which is delayed retinal breaks and detachments after acute posterior vitreous detachment. This is by Josh Orr and all on the team from Wills Eye Hospital. Senior author is Jason Hsu. Priya, being your alma mater, do you want to tell us a little bit about this study and what they showed?
Yeah, I would love to. So this was a single study centered practice looking at eyes who presented with an acute posterior vitreous detachment between October 2015 and August 2018. And they basically used billing codes of a PVD along with a history of an extended ophthalmoscopy to identify charts. And they looked also at these charts at a diagnosis of laser retinopexy, cryopexy, retinal detachment repair. And basically what their goal was to determine the timing between diagnosis of PVD and treatment, specifically looking at the patients who were not diagnosed with a retinal tear at the time of an acute PVD, to see what is the average time to developing a retinal tear or detachment after initial diagnosis of PVD if a tear or detachment was not found on an initial visit. And what they did is they looked at all of these eyes. Any eye that had a delayed break or detachment was looked at to confirm that they truly did have that on examination. And then they also looked at a reference group of the first 100 presenting eyes who did not have a break or detachment to compare the risk factors between both groups. So in terms of their results, they had around 7,999 eyes that had an acute PVD, and 16% or 1,280 had a retinal break, and 499 or 6.2% had a retinal detachment on presentation. But I thought the most interesting thing about the study was the delayed breaks and detachments. So they found that 2.6% of patients had a delayed retinal break, and 1.0% of patients had a delayed retinal detachment. But interestingly, out of the patients who had delayed retinal breaks, 55% were less than 6 weeks, but 44.5% were found greater than 6 weeks after initial presentation, which kind of goes against what we all think, that an acute PVD, a tear will happen right away or within the first 6 weeks. This does kind of go against that thinking. Similarly, for delayed detachments, 32.5% were found less than 6 weeks, but 67.5% were found greater than 6 weeks after the initial presentation of an acute PVD. Then they looked furthermore to see if there were any specific risk factors that could suggest that a patient would be at a higher risk for having a delayed break or a delayed detachment. And they found that vitreous hemorrhage and male sex were both statistically significant risk factors to have a delayed break or detachment respectively. A pseudophakia was also a risk factor for a delayed detachment. And older age was slightly protective, but this was not significant. And so I found this study to actually just be really useful information. It's actually something that after reading, I've quoted to every patient that I see now with an acute PVD, which is that it's first reassuring that only 2.6% and 1% of patients are going to go on to developing a problem after a retinal physician sees them, which is reassuring, first of all. But I let them know that they can still have a problem now, even more than 6 weeks after I see them. And I think that this information definitely gives some power and is definitely surprising. And it goes against what I would think most retina specialists think. And so I found that this study is just very, very useful on a daily clinical, in a daily clinical practice.
And that was really great. I think we saved the best for last. These are all great papers, but I love this one because there's so much to chew on and to kind of digest here. Srijay, I'm not going to put you on the spot, but I am going to put you on the spot because, and I'm going to tell you what I do too. So what do you tell a patient goes with a PVD? You don't find a break. What's your follow-up schedule? And does this study change it? Because Priya kind of referenced that.
Yeah, you know, normally I would get them back in that 4 to 6 week window. And I think that, you know, I usually tell patients the same thing, kind of what Priya's talking, that, you know, there is still a possibility of new retinal break formation. You know, this is under the assumption that I've not missed a retinal break, and that they need to kind of be on the lookout for the normal, you know, signs and symptoms that we all kind of talk about. Something that was really interesting here, if you kind of dive into the data, and, you know, I agree, this was my favorite paper, just because it was so full of numbers. But if you look at the people that formed a delayed retinal break, the median time to the formation, you know, it still has to do a lot more with their timing of visits, was 35 days. And if you think that, you know, delayed retinal break and delayed retinal detachment are all along the spectrum, the delayed retinal detachment group, their median time to finding was 75 days. So, you know, if you think about, you know, visit window, you know, really, if you go 75 days, there's this thought that these retinal breaks could have progressed to what they found was retinal detachment. So you really want to kind of hone in on that earlier, you know, kind of biasing early for their follow-up and getting them in, you know, like around the 35-day mark and making sure that if they do have this break, you can treat it and, you know, obviously reduce their potential morbidity associated with a retinal detachment. And so in terms of altering, you know, I still always have the same conversation I have with these patients that, you know, they're still, their risk is not zero. I usually tell them that after a second exam, if things are good, then their risk goes quite a bit down, almost close to zero. But this really does reaffirm my belief that they really do need to come back in for follow-up and basically as thorough of an exam that you gave them the first time around.
Yeah, and there's interesting, the risk factors for new breaks as well as, you know, RD is vitreous hemorrhage. I think we've all learned that. And if there's blood in the vitreous, we're always more cognizant, the risk is higher. Male gender is interesting. And I don't know, they go into some theories on that, possibly more trauma, maybe that the PVD progresses slower in men than at women because of different biologic differences, which may be true. I would also posit that we don't know if, it, again, examination, we're assuming that each exam is equal, but just speaking from experience, who knows? I mean, are men and women as easy to examine or as compliant with scleral depressive examination? We don't know the answer to that. Pseudophakia is a risk factor. I think there's a couple of reasons that have been suggested for that, and this is for delayed RD. One is that sometimes the pupil doesn't dilate as well. There's capsular phimosis. There may be reasons why the exam is not as good, but also there does seem to be a tendency. We've all seen this in surgery for these small breaks in pseudophakic eyes that are very small and develop over time. The vitreous seems to behave a little differently. You know, Priya, you did such a wonderful job kind of summarizing this and talking about how it impacts your approach and your counseling of PVD patients. So I guess the big takeaway for me is I think I'm just going to kind of keep them a little closer. I think this is a great study because it kind of gives us some justification for those follow-up visits. They talk about from a cost-benefit analysis, it's been shown that if you can just, what is it? They said that if the break rate was 0.1%, that it would be enough to justify the delayed break rate. If you could do that, that would justify follow-up patients after initial perspective. And here, even if they have zero risk factors, 0.7% of the eyes still had a delayed retinal break. That's not as low as we think, right? That's, you know, somewhere around 1 in 140. So that's not that low given how many PVDs get referred to retina practices. So again, Srijay, you really talked about the importance of that second exam. Priya, that you did too, and that's critical here. Any other thoughts, Priya, or anything else that jumped out when you're reading this paper?
You know, I thought another interesting thing is the patients who had delayed breaks and detachments, only 40% had new symptoms if they had a tear, and I think it was 68% had new symptoms for detachment, which also, I think, even further shows the importance of that second exam. A lot of these patients were asymptomatic. And so while I definitely counsel my patients that if they have new symptoms, I think oftentimes now, I'm just going to stress that second exam a lot more. And I think having these numbers definitely gives us power to confidently talk to patients and explain why we're having them come in and what we're looking for, and show that they're not always out of the woods, even if they have no breaks on initial exam.
That's a great point. And I think sometimes it's really difficult for us to counsel patients. I've said this before when I have students or residents with me. I think that you have patients who already have floaters and or flashes. And then what symptoms do we give them? We tell them to, if their floaters and or flashes increase, that to come and get examined. I think it's appropriate because those can be signs of a new symptomatic break. But many of these patients may detect no change. And I think that can be, that's a frustrating part of what we do for patients and doctors alike, where we don't necessarily have the best tells of what areas the retina are going to tear. We can look in clinically, you know, certain things like lattice or an area of traction may become a tear. But, and we don't have to go off on a whole tangent, but I've always thought that as we get going forward in the future, if we could get really good imaging of the vitreoretinal interface out to the periphery, you probably could map out areas of traction, identify potential problem areas in advance. And that's not a unique idea, but I always kind of thought that was a cool idea because the symptoms are really nebulous, right, Shriji?
Yeah, I was interested. I agree with what people were saying. You know, I'll lean on symptoms quite a bit. You know, I'll really ask patients, you know, how they notice more floaters or more flashing. But clearly, I agree, it's a very unreliable metric. And, you know, as you can see here, quite a few of the patients did not have any change or any new symptoms. And so clearly, that's not something that we can depend on. I agree, if we could have, you know, wider mapping out of areas of thing or areas of concern, we could hone in on it. But as far as I can tell, it appears fairly random. And so it really does stress the importance of, you know, a second thorough depressive.
Well, guys, I really appreciate you guys taking the time to go through these papers and discuss, and definitely, especially that last paper, a lot of food for thought. I'm not going to exclude you guys from the sports conversation. We were talking football before we started recording. None of us are fans of any good teams, but Priya, the Cowboys are reasonably good. You're a Cowboys fan. They've lost like 3 games in a row. They don't look good. They still are in first place in division. Why is Jason Garrett still the coach of the Cowboys?
You know, I love Coach Garrett. I actually got to meet him.
What?
I think he's a really good person, but I think there is a chance, as with any of these coaches, that he will not continue to be a coach. But on a very personal level, I really like him.
Why do you like Jason Garrett? I'm so confused.
I think he's a really nice person. I'm a terrible football fan. I think he's a good person, maybe not a great coach. But as for your question as to why he's still the coach, I think the biggest question there is how long will he remain? And I think there's a lot of talk, and we'll see what Jerry Jones wants to do. He always has a plan.
Srigi, you're a Bucks fan. I don't even know what to ask you. Is Jameis Winston gone?
Yeah, you know, if you look at Jameis Winston, I mean, he's thrown, you know, he's accounted for over 100 turnovers since he's come into the league, which is about 40 more than the next closest person. And most of the people on that list are not working in the NFL, or certainly not starting quarterbacks. And so, you know, you can see it even from his game today, you know, 450 yards, you know, a bunch of touchdowns, 3 interceptions, you know, it's a pick six. It's not winning football. He's probably got to go.
He's the master of the pick six.
I think throw ever in the NFL was a pick six.
Was it a pick six? Like it's either throwing it basically at a defender in the middle of the field, or it's throwing that like hanging out route that just hangs out there for a cornerback or safety, and they're just waiting for it.
Yeah, it's basically clearing out almost all of your offensive team to one side and then throwing it, you know, in the least likely place where you could actually complete a pass, and there's only defenders.
Well, I'm a Dolphins fan, so I don't really have anything to make fun of you guys for. They've just been so bad. I mean, actually, I would say this. I mean, Srigi, ironically, your team is the team that's had most success most recently. I mean, the Bucs won a Super Bowl 17 years ago. That's still the highlight between the three of us. You know, the Cowboys have made the playoffs a couple of times. Priya was like in a crib when the Cowboys won their last Super Bowl. I mean, Dan Marino tore his Achilles the year before I started watching the Dolphins. Like, this is just, NFL is amazing to me. We've talked about this before. Because for a sport with 30 teams, with a salary cap and all the turnover and 50-something players where, like, individual players shouldn't matter as much, I feel just like certain teams are just always bad. It's like for decades, and it doesn't make any sense. because there's turnover in coaching and management and players, but they just stay bad. It's really, really interesting.
I think it speaks a lot to the culture of the team because, you know, you're drafting at the top, you're getting the top players. You would think that they, you know, there's salary caps, there's a level playing field on that front. But, you know, certain cultures, certain organizations, you know, Redskins, Bucks, all the people that we like, they don't necessarily have that winning culture versus, you know, Patriots, Packers, Steelers, you know, years of knowing how to win and how to construct football teams. And I think that that kind of trickles down throughout the entire organization.
Yeah, the shame with Dallas is they actually have a very good culture, I feel like. Like Jason Garrett's a nice guy, and they have good
which
players.
Which is obviously the most important metric, is how nice your coach is.
Well, because Bill Belichick's like the nicest guy ever, right?
Yeah.
Nice guys finish last in football sometimes. I mean, who's the last nice coach who was successful? It's got to be like Tony Dungy or something, right? It's like...
Tony Dungy was a classically nice guy.
Yeah.
And then he was ousted, and then John Gruden came in and won the Super Bowl.
And he is not a nice guy.
No.
Yeah. All right, guys. Well, I appreciate your time. Thanks for doing this. Have a wonderful holiday season, and I'll talk to you soon.
Yeah, thanks, Greg. Thanks, Greg.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
Thank you so much. Bye.
As always, you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. All 204 episodes, including this one, can be found there sorted by category. You also find our blog, Equal Round and Reactive Lessons from Our Pupils. Here's a huge update. You can now claim CME credits for select podcast episodes via the AAO website. Remember to log in as an AAO member and visit the link in the episode description. Remember, on our website, you can sign up for our mailing list that gets you updates on the most recent episodes. You can subscribe in the Apple Podcast Store as well as the Android Store. You can also find us on Facebook or in the Apple Podcast Store or Android Store directly on your mobile device. We're on Twitter at Retina Podcast. You can always contact us by clicking on the contact link on our website or emailing us at retinapodcast@gmail.com. Thank you again for all the positive reviews you leave in those various places, and please giving feedback on things we can do better, things we are already doing well, and ideas for future episodes. Many thanks to Dr. Sharma and Dr. Patel for joining me. Thanks to Dr. Louis Kai, Dr. Angela Chang, and Dr. Michael Venenkasa for preparing this episode. Listeners, thank you for what you do on a daily basis, the patient care you provide, the articles you read and publish, and the conversations you inspire. This is Jay Schrader, signing off.
The feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.